Good morning, and thank you all for coming. We're going to have five speakers this morning. I'll introduce them all, including myself. My name is Stephen Kretzmann. I'm an analyst with the Institute for Policy Studies, and I've worked on oil issues for about the last decade. From Tuscaloosa, Alabama to Tucson, Arizona, from London, England to Logansport, Indiana, more than 100 demonstrations are taking place today at gas stations in the United States and the UK to send the message of no war for oil. Demonstrators are condemning military action and are calling on the Bush and Blair administrations to reduce their nation's dependence on oil as a key step towards sane national security and energy policies. The Bush administration, backed up by a chorus of pundits, vehemently denies that oil provides any rationale for war. The denials are so absolute, so acerbic in tone, that it is hard not to conclude that they protest a bit too much. No conflict can ever be understood by looking at just one factor. But the peace movement's rallying cry of no blood for oil has resonance and power because it holds more than a grain of truth when talking about any proposed military action in Iraq. Since the Arab oil embargo of 1973, successive U.S. administrations have equated national security with access to and control of oil, particularly the Persian Gulf, which holds an amazing two-thirds of global oil reserves. In January 1980, the lingering fear generated by that embargo, combined with events such as the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, forced U.S. strategists to draw a line in the sand. During what would become his last State of the Union address, President Carter first specifically articulated the Persian Gulf as a vital interest of the United States and pledged to defend that interest by any means necessary, including military force. 20 years later, newly appointed Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham unveiled the Bush-Cheney administration's process to create a new national energy strategy, quote, founded on the understanding that diversity of supply means security of supply. Although the administration knows that there is simply not enough excess oil in the world to displace the central role of Saudi Arabia, the hope is that by maximizing sources of oil from elsewhere, the power of the Saudis to influence the market will be somewhat diminished. Because of this fact, U.S. military and energy strategies have become intertwined around the world. In the Caspian region, Georgian President Edvard Shevardnadze recently noted that the prospect of using the U.S. military to guard transportation routes for Caspian energy resources to world markets is quite realistic. In Colombia, the Bush administration's recent decision to allocate $98 million to train a critical infrastructure brigade of Colombians explicitly to protect Occidental Petroleum's pipeline fuels the idea that our involvement in the region, including neighboring Venezuela, is about oil. Similarly, in West Africa, which could soon supply 25% of U.S. oil imports, credible rumors are swirling regarding the establishment of a U.S. military base on the small island of Sao Tome. If security of supply is indeed the Bush-Cheney administration's goal, securing Iraq's oil goes a long way towards achieving it. Iraq holds the world's second largest reserves of oil. The U.S. Energy Administration estimates Iraq's possible reserves at 220 billion barrels, or approximately 80% of current proven Saudi reserves. Post-Saddam Iraq would soon be in a position to dramatically increase production to at least 6 million barrels a day by 2010. In other words, in the worst-case scenario that U.S. planners fear, that the flow of Saudi oil was slowed or stopped, an increase in Iraqi oil production could, at least for a time, begin to make up for the loss. But apart from any disaster scenario, a revitalized Iraqi oil industry will certainly lessen the power of Saudi Arabia to manipulate the oil market and the global economy. 30 years ago when the oil embargo shocked America, or 20 years ago when the Carter Doctrine was just taking hold, alternative energy was in its infancy. Today, though, hybrid cars are being mass-produced, and prototype hydrogen fuel cell vehicles are being driven in California. The solutions to our dilemma are here now. Now more than ever, the only barriers to a clean energy economy that frees us from dependence on oil are political, not technical. Whether oil is the most important factor in going to war, or merely one of many considerations, is a debate that may never be settled. but by any objective standard, the body of evidence that oil is a factor in the rush to war in Iraq far outweighs the evidence that Iraq possesses weapons of mass destruction or that it is connected to Al-Qaeda. The burden of proof that oil is not a factor should now be on the administration, not on those who are merely drawing logical conclusions based on available evidence. Thank you very much. Next up, we're going to hear from Elizabeth Hood, who's a spokesperson for the Sierra Student Coalition, a national network of students that has organized over 50 demonstrations today.
My name is Elizabeth Hood. I'm a 17-year-old senior at Walter Johnson High School in Bethesda, Maryland. I'm a member of the Sierra Student Coalition, the largest student-run environmental organization in the country with 25,000 members. As a student, I recognize the effect the threat of war has on me, my peers, and future generations. And I, like many other students across the nation, object to fighting a war for oil. I and many other students whom I have met have shown a great deal of passion and commitment by participating in rallies and organizing activism opportunities for students in their areas. We recognize the importance of this issue and refuse to sit back and allow a war to be fought in our name. I remember a few weeks ago, I invited a friend of mine to an anti-war rally. She declined my invitation, saying that she didn't think she could make a difference because she was just a kid. She is just a kid, and so am I. But after all, it is just kids, my peers, that will be giving up their lives and fighting in a war for oil. My peers and I are the ones who will be faced with an unsustainable future dependent on oil. For these reasons, I strongly believe that it is important to be involved in fighting against the war. It truly is my generation that will be hit the hardest by the consequences of war. I've always believed strongly in democratic ideals, and I consider it a privilege to be an American citizen. Some people believe it's patriotic to die for your country in war. I believe it's patriotic to make my voice heard when I oppose a war I feel is unjust. The amount of energy I have seen from other students on this issue, the passion and dedication they exert in protesting against this war, has been truly inspirational to me. It also reaffirms my belief that every young person can make a difference. On the weekend of the anti-war rallies in Washington, on January 18th through 20th, I had four very dedicated high school activists travel 24 hours round trip from Maine on a hot, stuffy bus to stay with me and partake in the anti-war activities that took place that weekend. I remember as we marched to the streets of Washington, we looked behind us and in front of us, and we realized that we weren't the only ones that cared about these issues. In fact, we blended into a sea of people, many thousands of them high school and college students. I remember talking to one of my friends after that weekend. He told me of how affected he had been by the weekend, by the dedication of the students. He said that it was just so reassuring for him to see people who didn't know each other, or who came from completely different backgrounds, religions, and races, all coming together under a common cause. Today, again, people will be coming together under a common cause. Across the nation and around the world, many of America's young people, like me, will be protesting at gas stations, recognizing the link between sustainable energy and energy security, and demonstrating their objection to a war for oil. There are 20 high school actions that will be occurring across the nation today, and dozens of college ones. Students are organized, they are passionate and energetic. We care about what happens in the world. After all, it really is our future.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Next up, it's my pleasure to introduce the Executive Director of Greenpeace USA, which has been very active in the fight for peace here at home, John Pascantando.
Thank you for coming out this morning. First, let me just give you a quick update on the status of the Rainbow Warrior, the Greenpeace flagship, the Rainbow Warrior. Approximately 10 days ago, we deployed it to block a port in the south of England, Southampton. It anchored in the mouth of the port so that the military supply ships that were being loaded with war material destined for the Gulf region could not depart. The Rainbow Warrior and its crew held forth there for 6 days. The Ministry of Defense went to a high court and asked for an order that the Rainbow Warrior be removed. The Ministry of Defense's request was denied. And then the Ministry of Defense came in with its boats, police boats, and a Royal Navy tugboat, cut the Rainbow Warrior anchor chain, and towed it to the side. currently, beginning this morning, Greenpeace activists peacefully occupied British military vehicles en route to the Gulf as part of an ongoing global campaign against war in Iraq. In this action to stop a UK military attack, 14 Greenpeace volunteers entered Southampton's Marchwood military port and occupied tanks and jeeps queued up to leave on the roll-on, roll-off ferry Stena Shipper. Four of the volunteers climbed onto tanks and secured the hatches behind them. That's all I know at this point, and we will have more later if you are interested in following that. So that's the update on the Rainbow Warrior. To the extent that this threatened and looming war is about oil, it is, of course, tragic that we have a government that has done everything it can to undermine efforts to make Americans conserve oil, to use our fossil fuels more intelligently, instead of being the most profligate users of fossil fuels in the world, making our country dependent on oil supply lines from many unstable parts around the world. To the extent that this war is about disarmament, we at Greenpeace, of course, think disarmament is a moral and just cause and have worked towards it for 31 years. Nevertheless, when a government says that it strives for disarmament while undermining nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons treaties, and then threatening to bomb the cities and that thereby the civilians of another country, this, we believe, is unconscionable. This, we believe, is the wrong way to deal with the great opening conflict of the 21st century. I am proud to be here today with a diverse array of people who are voicing their support against this war at a time when there are so many loud and shrill and angry voices for violence. We oppose violence in all its forms. Last night I was watching the movie Duck Soup, the Marx Brothers movie about the country that he called Fredonia, and about a country preparing to go to war. And my four-year-old, I found that these are very funny movies that an adult can enjoy and kids as young as four can enjoy as well. And my four-year-old said to me, "Daddy, what's this movie about?" And I said, "Well, what do you think it's about?" You know, the old trick, right? Throw it back if you're not sure. "What do you think it's about?" And she said, "That war is stupid." And I said, "Yeah, I think that sort of says it all." So thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, John. Unfortunately, Damu Smith seems to have been detained. So we're going to go now to a man who obviously needs no introduction, but I'll give a brief one anyway. Longtime consumer advocate and the founder of CitizenWorks, Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thank you all for coming. The situation with the Iraqi regime that President Bush has spoken again and again with belligerent sound bites on television week after week reflects his penchant for talking to the American people but not speaking with the American people. President George W. Bush has held only 7 full-scale press conferences since he was inaugurated. That is far less than any other recent president. President Bush has never received an anti-war delegation in the White House or anywhere else to discuss the views of informed Americans who disagree with him about policies affecting the safety and well-being of this country and the world. He has refused to meet with anti-war delegations from the retired military and intelligence people, from the clergy, from human rights, from labor, from academics, from Nobel Prize winners, civic leaders, and business leaders. Increasingly, these groups are asking for a meeting. They are receiving nothing but silence in return. Despite well-known ties to big oil, Bush administration officials have managed to keep a straight face as they insist that the drive to war against Iraq is motivated only by an effort to eliminate weapons of mass destruction and establish democracy. It's not credible that there would be such a strong push for war if there were no oil in Iraq. Oil is power, and this in significant measure is a struggle over that power. The government in Washington is one of the world's leading experts in overthrowing regimes it doesn't like. And this has been the case for many years, including overthrowing Mossadegh in Iran that ushered in the regime of the Shah in the 1950s. If the purpose of the Bush administration is to replace Saddam Hussein and disarm that regime, it's interesting that they are not exercising their coup d'etat skills over the last 10 years, especially since the regime is surrounded by hostile enemies that are far more powerful than the Hussein regime, and bookended by hostile internal forces, including the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north. So instead of a coup d'etat, the United States government under George Bush wants to invade. Why the difference? Because when you invade, you control the country. And when you control the country, you control the second biggest petroleum pool in the Middle East. The connections between the Bush administration and the oil industry are clear and pervasive. This is a government in Washington that is marinated in oil. A remarkable 41 members of the administration have ties to the industry, and both the president and the vice president are both former oil executives. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice is a former director of Chevron, even had an oil tanker named after her, since renamed. President Bush took more than $1.8 million in campaign contributions from the oil and gas industries in the 2000 election. The Bush people and the oil moguls do agree with one another, in part because they are one another. With influence like that, it's no surprise that the big oil corporations like ExxonMobil, with an annual lobbying budget here in Washington of nearly $12 million, and Halliburton Corporation, Vice President Cheney's former employer, have had an unprecedented role in determining the nation's energy policies. What we don't know yet is whether Vice President Cheney and members of the American Petroleum Institute specifically discussed Iraq in the secretive meetings of the National Energy Task Force, since he absolutely refuses congressional demands to release many of the task force documents, which would indicate who he met with and the general outlines of what was discussed. But we do know that the vice president's energy strategy casts a growing dependence on oil as an inevitable source of energy, recommending that, quote, in his words, that the president make energy security a priority of our trade and foreign policy, end quote. The energy situation we have now is precarious. The United States currently consumes 19.5 million barrels a day, or 26% of the daily global oil consumption. With just 2% of the world's proven reserves, the U.S. imports 9.8 million barrels a day, or more than half the oil we consume. We import oil from Iraq, by the way. Tens of thousands of barrels. Interesting contradiction. Instead of remedying this dangerous dependence with increased fuel efficiency standards and other efficiency measures, the vice president's national energy strategy propels the country down an even more perilous road that it says will require 17 million barrels of oil a day imported by 2020, lining the pockets of multinational oil companies while polluting the environment and committing the United States military to continued international hostilities. The surest way for the U.S. to sustain its overwhelming dependence upon oil is to control the 67% of the world's proven oil reserves that lie beneath the sands of the Persian Gulf. Control one way or the other. Iraq alone has proven reserves of 112.5 billion barrels, or 11% of the world's remaining supply, with possible reserves of almost twice that. Only Saudi Arabia has more. U.S. oil multinationals have been banned from Iraqi oil fields for more than a decade, while French, Russian, and Chinese companies are lined up to profitably tap into Iraq's reserves under the present regime there, Bush administration officials incredulously claim that Iraqi officials installed by the U.S. will independently choose who produces the oil after the war. Plans are already being laid. The Wall Street Journal reported on January 16th that officials from the White House, State Department, and Department of Defense have been meeting informally with executives from Halliburton, Schlumberger, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Texaco, ConocoPhillips to plan the post-war oil bonanza. You imagine how many of these companies have merged? Years ago, these mergers would have been stopped immediately by the Justice Department. Imagine Exxon merging with oil, with Mobil, number one, merging with number two. The American people have a right to know what is being discussed in these meetings about the oil industry's designs on this gigantic pool of petroleum, and what, if any, assurances they're being given by what is supposed to be our government. Clearly, there's a better means of achieving U.S. energy security. Instead of relying on costly military ventures in unstable countries with shocking forthcoming casualties affecting innocent people, instead of relying on this approach to ensure a steady source of oil, we need a national energy security strategy that is expeditious, self-sufficient, and environmentally sustainable. The auto companies have been selling consumers cars that figuratively leak badly. It's like selling households leaky faucets that are designed to leak. The inefficiency of motor vehicles would stagger even a moribund engineering imagination. And the inefficiency is increasing, not decreasing. The average fuel efficiency of the nation's passenger vehicles is at its lowest level since 1980. And 40% of all U.S. petroleum demand goes to fuel the country's cars, SUVs, vans, and light trucks. We must and can't reverse this downward trend. President Bush's much-vaunted hydrogen vehicle initiative will do virtually nothing to improve the efficiency of the 17 million passenger vehicles that will roll off the assembly lines every year between now and 2020, when some hydrogen vehicles may be viable. This is assuming renewable energy is available to generate the hydrogen in the first place. President Bush's strategy regarding motor vehicles right out of General Motors' book, which is get people to think 30 years ahead without any deadlines or reality in that horizon so that they don't focus on today and tomorrow's motor vehicles. This is a strategy that was played out in the 1939 World's Fair, where General Motors had its Futurama and had all kinds of dazzling motor vehicle designs in 1939 that we're still waiting for in 2002. According to the Union of Concerned Scientists, conventional technological improvements are currently available which could boost average fuel efficiency standards to more than 40 miles per gallon, including direct fuel injection, variable valve control engines, high-strength lightweight materials, and low-rolling resistance tires, not to mention many other simple changes. In addition, hybrid electric vehicles that achieve 55 miles per gallon are already selling in the tens of thousands in our country by Toyota and Honda. This technology is operational now, obviously, but instead of forcing Detroit to adopt these immediately available improvements to today's gas-guzzling fleet, the president is promising Detroit $1.7 billion in corporate welfare gifts to daydream about next-generation hydrogen-based vehicles while doing virtually nothing to make improvements next year and the years after. Each day, more and more Americans are realizing that the perverse priorities of the Bush-Cheney oligarchy are driving the war against Iraq. That's why thousands of concerned citizens are demonstrating today at gas stations around the country and other parts of the world, and that's why, as has been reported, many retired generals, admirals, and other retired officers are arguing that this pending war diverts, distracts, and is likely to produce blowbacks against the safety and security of the United States, not to mention the informed internal dissent among military and intelligence agencies in the Bush government that is now being muted. The demand is simple. Stop this war before it starts and immediately establish a sane national energy security strategy. Also, start devoting taxpayer resources in our government to waging peace for a change. Half of the entire federal expenses of our government, aside from Social Security and Medicare, are now going to military products and services. Half. That is unprecedented in modern history for a country that has no territorial designs on other nations and for a country that has no major enemy with the end of the Soviet Union and the changes in communist China. One half of the entire federal budget and growing is going for the military purposes. People want more information. We have more information. The website, citizenworks.org, is full of information about these matters, as well as about the corporate crime wave that has looted trillions of dollars from millions of Americans, including their pensions. Citizenworks.org also offers a free electronic newsletter every week that describes developments in the area of corporate crime, fraud, and abuse. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ralph. As long as we're plugging websites, targetoil.com, if you go there, you can see a list of all the confirmed demonstrations that we have today. There are over 100 up there. There's also further background on oil and war and a lot of good ways to keep in touch and get more information. I'll also mention briefly that following the press conference at noon, there'll be a demonstration at the American Petroleum Institute at 12th and L Northwest. Obviously, you're all very much welcome to come out and cover that as well. So now, questions.
Hannah Bookdell, CNN. With Powell going to the UN Security Council tomorrow and presenting what he considers to be evidence of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program, if he presents something that you would deem credible, how would that change your views?
He can't present anything different because everybody knows that Saddam Hussein has chemical and biological warfare materials because our government under the Reagan and Bush administration sold it to him. Sold him the raw materials. We have the receipts under export license by the Department of Commerce, well documented by the news media and reported in great detail in a 1994 report by the Senate Banking Committee. That's never been the issue. The issue is whether he has a delivery potential and intent to use these chemical and biological warfare materials to harm his neighbors or other countries. And the proof that he does not have that intent because he doesn't like to commit suicide is that if in the last 10 years he had chemical and biological warfare materials, a delivery system, and an intent to harm his neighbors, the Israeli military powerhouse would have obliterated him immediately. That's the acid test. So any kind of evidence that he produces is nothing but redundancy. It's no surprise. We know he has these materials because we have the receipts. Corporations were given export licenses in both Western Europe, Germany, and the United States to sell him these materials when he was considered our ally against Iran. We helped install Saddam Hussein. The record is clear. The CIA favored his installation many years ago as the ruler of Iraq. We funded him. We armed him. We provided him with logistic intelligence in the war against Iran. And it's not surprising that he is maintaining residual materials from the raw materials, including anthrax, VX, and other deadly weapons that were sold in raw material form to him by U.S. companies with the approval of the Department of Commerce.
So at what point does that shift take place, though, where war or military action would become, in your mind, justified?
U.N. action against any country that threatens its neighbors with military destruction under international law is justified. And that's why the issue is, but Saddam Hussein, who controls only one-third of his country, who is surrounded by Iran, Turkey, and Israel, far more powerful military adversaries, who's under constant surveillance, is presenting a credible threat to his neighbors. His neighbors don't think so. If they did, they would have taken care of the situation immediately. So the issue is the presence of a threat. As many former retired generals, admirals, and intelligence officials have stated ad infinitum, this is a situation where the war drums are being beaten by chicken hawks, starting with President Bush, Mr. Cheney, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, John Ashcroft, all of whom supported the Vietnam War when they were young, but wanted other Americans to do the fighting for them, all of whom evaded the draft. On the other side are people like General Zinni, people like Admiral Shanahan, and intelligence officials, many of whom actually have signed an ad in the newspapers against the drive to war not long ago, have counseled that this war will destabilize the Middle East, will increase the likelihood of terrorism, will have a blowback effect on the United States, will divert attention from settling other more important disputes in the Middle East, and will waste enormous resources detrimental to our economy. And yet, President Bush is not listening. He does not listen. He told Bob Woodward he makes decisions in his gut. That may be okay for a football coach, but not for the President of the United States.
As for Greenpeace, there is no point, no threshold at which we advocate or support violence. And we are here to be a part of this broad array of voices speaking out for peace, because the advocates for violence are many and are loud. And so war doesn't need any more supporters, regardless of the evidence that may be forthcoming. There needs to be a push on behalf of citizens from nations all across the world to demand that this conflict be solved peacefully.
And I would just add that the commonality among all of us up here and the dozens of endorsing organizations that you can find listed on targetoil.com is we all believe that oil is a key factor in motivating this war, and that's why we're here today.
I'm asking with Television Spain. You talk about oil being a motivating factor for the war in Iraq. I mean, we have the former CIS countries who have huge reserves of oil, and of course, exploring that oil will not create a war situation. So why Iraq and not the CIS states? I mean, we already are exploring.
First of all, the reserves in Iraq alone, much less the Persian Gulf in general, are much, much larger than they are in the former CIS states, right? I mean, Iraq alone is proven at 11% and possibly as high as 20% of global reserves. The Caspian region has some wild estimates that are really high, but hasn't proven to be anywhere near that high. The other part of that answer is, the U.S. military is active in the Caspian. We just gave $4.5 million to Azerbaijan, and President Aliyev there said that this is for the protection of the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. $68 million to Georgia. President Shevardnadze said this is for the protection of the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline. Turkey, the cooperation is well documented and well known. All of this is about securing energy transport corridors out of the Caspian. You know, you don't have anyone there who's not willing to go along with the U.S. agenda, which maybe is why you don't have quite the level of conflict that you do in Iraq. It's at least part of the reason. It's
a follow-up question. Do you think that if and when the U.S. goes to war, there's going to be a backlash in this country, not only from Americans, but also from the terrorist organizations?
I don't think that Americans want to see this country go to war over oil, and I think that people are going to already see this for what it is, and it will become only clearer over time. And I certainly hope and pray that nothing more serious happens.
Al Milliken, Washington Independent Writers. Does anyone have a critique of the Democratic Party response thus far? And specifically, are there any concerns over the reaction or the lack of reaction of declared presidential candidates?
I think the short answer is that we would like to see some real organized opposition to this war happening. It certainly seems like the poll numbers support the idea that the vast majority of Americans do not support unilateral action. And you're seeing some statements by the Democratic candidates, but probably not enough. We'd like to see some more leadership. I personally would.
Dwight Thompson, American Environment. Oil companies today use the argument that if we do invade Iraq and they take over the oil fields, supply will go down. So are there any estimates of profits now under the embargo versus an American occupation of Iraq?
I'm sorry. So you're saying, can you rephrase the question?
Are there any estimates of American oil companies' profits now under the current embargo versus what they would be if we invaded and they took over?
Yeah, I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, which is that supply would go down in the event of an invasion. Last week, the Pentagon planners gave a briefing about one of the top priorities in any initial warfighting scenario being to grab Iraqi oil fields, particularly Kirkuk in the north and Ramallah in the south, which in between the two of them account for 75% of Iraqi exports. So if special forces were used to secure those, as is being openly discussed, it's theoretically possible that Iraqi oil could continue to pump during that time, and I believe that's going to be a priority of the administration as they go forward with this war, assuming that they do. I don't have any clear estimates about the profit differential, if that's what you're asking. So, and John?
I don't have estimates on profits, but the two pieces of evidence that we have that get to your question of is there really evidence that U.S. oil companies would benefit from a war in Iraq? I take two outside pieces of information. One is British Petroleum has been publicly complaining that if there's a war, the Americans will favor Exxon when opening the Iraqi oil fields. And number two, a recent investment report by the Deutsche Bank on ExxonMobil said that ExxonMobil is in the pole position. It's a car racing term, meaning you're in the front. Is in the pole position to benefit from regime change in Iraq. So that's coming from the Deutsche Bank's best analyst on the oil industry.
Just one more thing on that, which is that in September, the Washington Post quoted Ahmed Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, saying that he favored the creation of a U.S. consortium of oil companies to develop Iraq's fields in the event of a regime change.
Tom Doggett with Reuters. This is for Mr. Nader and others. You criticize the desire of U.S. oil companies in particular to want to get into Iraq to tap those oil fields, but foreign investment is what is needed in Iraq to modernize Iraq's oil fields. Their production is way down compared to years ago or a decade ago. Would this not benefit the Iraqi people? Oil is the only thing Iraq sells that the world wants, and if you get more production, you would get more oil revenue, which presumably would go to the Iraqi people more than it does under Saddam Hussein now.
There's a lot of ways to answer that question. I think one of the most interesting is that there's a whole slew of new studies out from places like the World Bank, Stanford University, UCLA, that show an inverse correlation in between oil development and poverty. So the more a country relies on exporting oil, the more poor its people are likely to be. For a variety of reasons. Maybe it's corruption. It's because many developing country economies can't handle the amount of money that oil brings in a short period of time. It's, you know, there's a lot of different reasons behind that in the long run. But it's by far, it's a very optimistic assumption to believe that oil can be the backbone of development for a new peaceful Iraq.
Do you think Saddam Hussein now is sharing the oil revenue he gets for the benefit of his people?
I don't know. I would presume not. It certainly doesn't look that way.
So, but do you think under a new government post-Saddam, with oil production doubling and revenues doubling, there's a better chance of that money going to the benefit of the people?
I don't see that there's a better chance at all, because the evidence from places around the world, other countries in the Middle East, as well as countries like Nigeria, Colombia, Ecuador, Burma, etc., indicates that maybe not, even if it is a democratic country, in quotes, like Venezuela, the people are not often better off.
So are you saying the U.S. occupied government or transitional government would keep the money for themselves, or the U.S. government would take the money in itself?
There actually has been discussion about Iraqi oil proceeds being used to pay back the cost of any invasion. That's one of the things that's been discussed. I don't know what would happen. I mean, I'd like to believe that the money that's generated from that in a regime change, if it happens, could go for the benefit of the Iraqi people. All I'm saying is, you know, it's by no means a sure thing, and the balance of evidence suggests to date that it may not happen.
Laura McGinnis, also from Reuters, actually. I have a question for Mr. Nader about the SUV campaign. Just wondering if you could address issues you see with Americans' love of big cars, the popularity of large SUVs like the Humvee, and how you view arguments of drivers that those vehicles are actually safer, and how you sort of how you reconcile those issues between safety and fuel efficiency.
Well, for many years we helped build a safety consciousness among American motorists to demand safer cars, and the auto companies have seized on this to deceive many motorists into thinking that the SUVs, because they're larger, are safer. In fact, as the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has pointed out, they have a much higher fatal propensity for rollovers, destroying about 1,100 drivers' lives a year. Because of those instabilities and high center of gravity of these vehicles. Furthermore, when these vehicles smash into four-door or two-door sedans or cars, they inflict horrendous injuries on those occupants. So the SUV is a dangerous vehicle. It is a fuel inefficient, wasteful vehicle. It is a polluting vehicle. And it deceives buyers into thinking that they are safer because they're looking down on their neighboring drivers on a highway, and it's not true. So how did this come about? Because the Department of Transportation under various administrations succumbed to the lobbying of the auto industry and exempted SUVs from the normal fuel efficiency, safety, and pollution control standards that were applied to regular automobiles. And that chicken has come home to roost in a very devastating manner.
And so what would be your response when you see the Humvee or the H2 is becoming very popular? When you see drivers of that car, what's your response to the popularity of a very large...
The response is there needs to be regulation for safer motor vehicles. And if these SUVs are going to be built, they would have to be protective of family pocketbooks by achieving higher levels of fuel efficiency, protective of family lives by achieving higher levels of safety that the engineers in Detroit are fully capable of installing, and would no longer be so dangerous to motorist health by curbing their vast emissions, which just in the Washington, D.C. area is a significant contributor to the increase in air pollution in and around the nation's capital.
Do you associate demand for these large vehicles with the issue you're talking about today, or oil for, war for oil, and how do you link the two issues?
Wasteful energy technologies like motor vehicles create greater demand. Greater demand creates more reliance on imported and domestic oil, and that creates more economic waste for consumers and produces devastating environmental impacts. So these SUVs are weapons of mass destruction in their cumulative way, and they should be labeled the way a cigarette package is labeled, as being hazardous to their health, the health of their owners.
Take two more questions. Is it somebody who hasn't asked a question yet?
Al Milliken, WIW again. Does anyone think they have a realistic scenario about how oil fields would be dealt with once war would begin in Iraq? And how soon could the U.S. military gain control or the security of supply over oil? And if desperate, what could Saddam Hussein do with the oil that he controls?
I think you should probably ask the Pentagon that question. I mean, they certainly are prioritizing taking control of the Iraqi fields, as I mentioned before, Kirkuk in the north and Ramallah in the south. And I think they're going to do everything they can to make that happen. They're worried that he's going to blow them up. You'd have to talk to them about the various scenarios they're playing out. So, Tom?
Well, earlier you seemed to, again, getting back to the criticism of the military for wanting to take control of those fields. The Pentagon said they were doing it because they were worried that Saddam Hussein might sabotage them as he did in Kuwait. Isn't it a good idea that they should take control so they're not? I mean, this is, again, oil for the Iraqi people.
Certainly a bad idea that those oil fields get set on fire, whether by whomever. You know, and that's obviously no one wants to see that happen. You could say that it's for the Iraqi people and for the good of the Iraqi people. You could also say that it's for keeping oil flowing to the market and keeping prices down. You know, it sort of depends upon which end of the picture you're looking at.
Can't you have both? More oil going into the market, and then that oil that countries buy, that money would go to the Iraqi people.
If you believe that that money will eventually go for the benefit of the Iraqi people. I mean, this idea that we're going to go into house-to-house combat in Baghdad for the benefit of the Iraqi people seems kind of strange to me. I don't think you normally bomb people for their benefit, but that's...
On both of your questions, I just want to say that we disagree with the premise that the U.S. could launch this kind of violence, untold carnage towards people and towards the environment, and that somehow out the other side there'd be some benefit that would make it worth it. Oil supply, foreign investment, the premise is wrong. The violence can't be justified. Okay, that's all. And so we are here to express those voices for peace and peaceful solutions to this kind of conflict. Yes, there are problems there. Nobody's disagreeing with that. But there's just no way we can justify violence to come out that other side.
One last question.
Can you then justify a coup against Saddam, even if it were a violent coup, if there were lives lost? How do you deal with the Saddam? In fact, you think we need to deal with the Saddam?
I'll speak personally. I think there might be different answers up here on the podium. I'd like to see Saddam dealt with in the same way that General Pinochet was dealt with in Chile. You know, an international legal regime and efforts to try to bring him within an international legal framework. If the man is a war criminal, which there's certainly a lot of evidence to support that he is, he should be dealt with as a war criminal. And his people should not be made to suffer across the board. John?
Sure. Bring him to The Hague.
Bring him to The Hague.
How do you do that?
I mean... Obviously. Ask the Israelis who seem to be good at this kind of thing in Entebbe. I mean, you know, there are ways to do this kind of thing, and it doesn't seem that that is really on the table. That's it. So maybe then the real reason that we're going after this is control of oil, and that's sort of why we're all here again. So thank you very much. Demonstration at 12th and L at noon at the American Petroleum Institute. Thank you all for coming. We'll be available for questions now.